Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 1164 of the Juice Box Podcast. Welcome back to Cold Wind. Today, we're going to be speaking with someone who we're calling Aurora. She has type 1 diabetes, is a pediatric nurse in the ER. We talk about all kinds of stuff about the hospital, including how parents bring their children in constantly for unnecessary reasons. What is this note here? Also, much to your surprise, that a lot of children come into the ER with either fentanyl or marijuana overdoses. Oh, I remember her telling me this. Oh, you're going to find this interesting. Nothing you hear on the Juice Box Podcast should be considered advice, medical or otherwise. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your healthcare plan. How would you like to help type 1 diabetes research? Well, if you want to, it's easy. t1dexchange.org/juicebox. Finish the survey. It takes 10 minutes and you've helped. That's it. U.S. residents only. You have to have type 1 diabetes or be the caregiver of someone with type 1. Bonus points if you're male or the parent of a boy. They're really looking for those people right now, but everybody is welcome. t1dexchange.org/juicebox. Don't forget to save 40% off of your entire order at CozyEarth.com. All you have to do is use the offer code JUICEBOX at checkout. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by US Med. USMed.com/JUICEBOX or call 888-721-1514. US Med is where my daughter gets her diabetes supplies from, and you could too. Use the link or number to get your free benefits check and get started today with US Med. Today's episode is sponsored by Medtronic Diabetes, a company that's bringing together people who are redefining what it means to live with diabetes. Later in this episode, I'll be speaking with Mark. He was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at 28. He's 47 now. He's going to tell you a little bit about his story. And then at the very end of the episode, you can hear my entire mini interview with Mark. To hear more stories from the Medtronic Champion community or to share your own story, visit MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox and check out the Medtronic Champion hashtag on social media. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by the Eversense CGM. Eversense is going to let you break away from some of the CGM norms you may be accustomed to. No more weekly or bi-weekly hassles of sensor changes. Never again will you be able to accidentally bump your sensor off. You won't have to carry around CGM supplies. And worrying about your adhesive lasting? Well, that's a thing of the past. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. You're leaving it to me to pick your name?
Yeah.
Hold on a second. You know, I'm not good at this. Hold on a second. I'm going to say randomly generated. Female name. All right. 1, 2, 3, 4. You are. All right. Well, we don't want to make you Aurora, do we?
Sure. Why not? She's a princess.
Okay. Aurora. Aurora, what do you do for a living?
I am a pediatric emergency department nurse.
Pediatric peds ER nurse.
Correct.
Okay. Size of the hospital. Big, small, medium?
I mean, it feels big. I don't know what other pediatric hospitals are.
Okay. There's a distinction for the ER, right? Like trauma levels. What is yours?
I don't know that answer. We are not a level one trauma center.
Not a level one trauma center. Okay.
We are nationally ranked in pediatrics. That I know for sure. The thing is that our emergency department is too far from the operating rooms. So we therefore cannot have like a higher standing as in an emergency or like.
Oh, that's how that gets measured. Like literally steps. Yeah,
that's one of the measurements is how far the emergency department is from the operating room.
Okay.
As well as which overnight providers you have on call in the hospital or within a certain mileage. Okay. And so because we work with three other hospitals within my area,
they just take them there if they think they need that level.
No. Our providers can be anywhere. Our endocrinologists are our endocrinologists, but like, say we need for something, like say you come in and your kiddo who has type 1 has their appendix is perfed, right? So
did you just say the name of a hospital
that you didn't mean to say? I did not mean to. Sorry. It's
okay. Oh, sorry. We'll bleep that out.
But yeah, so they could be at any of the other hospitals in the area that they could be servicing. So it's not, it may take a little bit of time if they're not there or if there's a weird surgery situation.
Would they redirect an ambulance to where your thing is more easily helped, whatever's wrong with you at the moment?
For pediatrics, it depends. So we don't take traumas. Traumas would go elsewhere.
If I broke my leg, that's not really a trauma, and I end up in an ambulance, would they take me to a certain hospital?
They would take you to us.
Okay. Okay.
Otherwise, a broken leg could be a trauma if your bone is coming through your leg.
I see.
Like if the skin is open.
Right. Okay. All right. That makes sense. So how long, roughly have you had this position?
I have been in this position for a little over a year and a half now.
Year and a half. And prior to that, what did you do?
I worked in the same hospital in the medical portion, patient side for several years.
Okay.
Way too long.
So just tell me the progression of education. You leave high school. What do you do next?
Yeah, I leave high school. I start taking prereqs for nursing school. Mm-hmm. And that takes me, 7 years to finish prereqs because I was working full-time and going to school part-time because I had to pay for my diabetes supplies.
Okay.
And so it took me a very long time. I finished prereqs summer of 2019, and I was not able to get into nursing school. Ended up starting a different degree while I was waiting because nursing school in my area can take several years to get into. Mm-hmm. And COVID hit. I got into the program August 2020 and graduated nursing school in 2022, May 2022.
Okay.
Started in September 2022 in the emergency department.
Yeah. So you basically take 6 or 7 years. You're probably 25-ish when you get done with your prerequisites.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Then hard to get in because there's only so many slots, then COVID, et cetera. But by 20, well, that's a lot of time to try to get to something, huh? And then
I'm persistent.
Yeah. No kidding. So then by 2022, you're a nurse and you're working right away in ER or no, not right away. Right away. Okay. And why did you choose that? Today's podcast is sponsored by the Eversense CGM. Boasting a 6-month sensor, the Eversense CGM offers you these key advantages: distinct on-body vibe alerts when high or low, a consistent and exceptional accuracy over a 6-month period, and you only need 2 sensors per year. No longer will you have to carry your CGM supplies with you. You won't have to be concerned about your adhesive not lasting, accidentally knocking off a sensor, or wasting a sensor when you have to replace your transmitter. That's right, there's no more weekly or bi-weekly hassles of sensor changes, not with the Eversense CGM. It's implantable, and it's accurate. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. The Eversense CGM is the first and only long-term CGM. Eversense sits comfortably right under the skin in your upper arm, and it lasts way longer than any other CGM sensor. Never again will you have to worry about your sensor falling off before the end of its life. So if you want an incredibly accurate CGM that can't get knocked off and won't fall off, you're looking for the Eversense CGM. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox.
I come from where in the hospital I was working at, I would have up to 15 patients a day in the role that I was in. Mm-hmm. And on an acute care floor, so like med surg E floors or cancer care floors are acute care. So I knew going in, the nurses only had 3 to 4 patients. And to me, I was like, I'm going to be so bored. Okay. So bored. right? Like these patients for 12 hours a day, 3 days a week, a lot of them can be chronic. You know, we would have patients on our units for 2 years at a time, and then they'd come back and forth for whatever thing going on. And I was like, I don't want to do that. I don't, the emotional, social, the, like the relationships are great and you can have really great relationships with that, but it can be, I watched it be really taxing on the nurses.
Being too emotionally invested in people's health?
Yeah, or, you know, and I mean, for most people it's like a trigger thing. Like, we don't think in our culture about children dying, and children do die. Children get really sick and they die. And, you know, we do everything we possibly can, but a lot of the time we really just prolong it. And it's painful for the patient. It's painful for the family. It's.
I have a friend who's a NICU nurse, and they, when they first came out of school and were working, they'd find themselves being invited to funerals by families.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't prolong the life, that we shouldn't try to do everything that we can medically to have, let this child become an adult and have a thing, you know, like, and do all the normal people things that we do. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that to me,
it's a lot when you see people die.
It is. And I mean, it was just, I didn't think I would be happy, right? Okay. I didn't think I would find like good growth. And also at my hospital, so nurses have a variability of autonomy based on state, based on institution and the policies and autonomy, and then kind of like the breadth of their scope of practice, right? Inpatient, they do not have a good breadth or autonomy for scope of practice. And I've watched several, you know, so many doctors just snap at nurses for no reason. Like, and it just, I don't do well with that. So the emergency department, I did my senior practicum in, I really liked it. And I said, okay, it's going to be critical care all the way, because I love to use my brain. I love looking at labs and looking at the patient and how they look and their vital signs and putting it all together and being like, oh, wow, this is what's going on. And I know what I need to do now. I know what I need to ask for. Whereas acute care, you don't really have that.
Yeah. So you like the speed of it. You like the challenge of it. You like that there's more patients in a shift, so you don't get too attached to people.
Yeah. If a patient is in my emergency department room and I've had them for 4 hours, I walk into the room and I'm like, I'm sorry, you're seeing my face again. We're trying to figure it out. Like, I want them gone by like 4 hours, because nobody wants to be in an emergency department for that long.
Yeah. So what made you want to come on and do this recording?
I don't have a good answer. Let's go with that. But it's perplexing, the things that I hear people say, or the inequalities that I have seen in patients with diabetes who are coming in. And it's not just patients with diabetes, it's all, but I mean, this is a diabetes podcast, so that's what we're talking about.
Well, no, I'm happy to listen to whatever you want to say. It doesn't have to be about diabetes specifically. What do you mean it's confusing what people say?
It's not confusing. Like, it's surprising the crap that comes out of my coworkers' mouths. Like,
okay. Do you want to give me some examples?
Okay. So yesterday I was hanging blood, and it's a scary thing, right? But a couple of weeks ago, I had a nurse who was about to give a pen injection for insulin, right? And she's like, I'm always so terrified to give insulin. I'm like, why are you terrified? She goes, because it's such a high-risk medication. I was like, your body makes insulin. This is not scary.
How long do you think that person had been a nurse? Has been?
A year.
A year. Are there a lot of new nurses right now because of the shift after COVID?
I want to say yes, but I know that this emergency department would always take new grads. Okay. So I don't know the comparison.
Okay. So there's always new nurses coming.
Oh, always. And if they're not new nurses, they might be new to the ED, or they're travel nurses. You know, there's always a variability of like, but I mean, we have staff members who have been on staff for 20 years, been in the emergency department for 20 years, you know, okay. Nursing.
So the
and they're still bedside.
Is there turnover, but not with everybody? Like, some people come and go and some people stay long term. I guess once you get there, if it's really right for you, then you might settle into it.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So something as simple as, like, I'm scared to give insulin because it's a dangerous medication.
Yeah, which is understandable. But I was like, hey, your body makes insulin. It's totally fine. I was like, if they go low, they go low, which is not, it's a med error, right? If they do. But if they go low, you give them a little juice and they're fine. And we do not give enough insulin whatsoever in any form of this hospital to actually make a patient low unless you are way overdosing and not properly giving the insulin.
Are there other things that coworkers say that would be off-putting, but you're not personally attached to it? Like, it sounds like a little bit of your response to that was as a nurse, and a little bit of your response to that was as a type one. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it almost feels like a little bit, you're like, oh my God, like, you don't understand diabetes at all. That vibe. Like, how did it make you feel when they said that? You weren't pissed. You were just,
No.
Just like, oh, this another person who thinks the wrong thing.
We give insulin. We don't have a day where we don't have a diabetic in the emergency department, whether it's a new diagnosis or somebody's in sick day or somebody's in DKA.
Every day. Type 2s, type 1s, every day.
We don't really have type 2s.
Type 2s don't come to emergency?
Not pediatric.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
They don't usually have type 2 yet.
It's interesting. So you're a pediatric ER nurse. The place isn't just for endocrinology, but there is a good endocrinology department there, so you see a lot of these people. Is that about how that works? Right now, we're going to hear from a member of the Medtronic Champion community. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by Medtronic Diabetes. And this is Mark.
I used injections for about 6 months, and then my endocrinologist in the Navy recommended a pump.
How long had you been in the Navy?
8 years up to that point.
I've interviewed a number of people who have been diagnosed during service, and most of the time they're discharged. What happened to you?
I was medically discharged. Yeah, 6 months after my diagnosis.
Was it your goal to stay in the Navy for your whole life, your career?
It was. Yeah. In fact, I think a few months before my diagnosis, my wife and I had that discussion about, you know, staying in for the long term. And, you know, we'd made the decision despite all the hardships and time away from home. That was what we loved the most.
Was the Navy a lifetime goal of yours?
Lifetime goal. I mean, as my earliest childhood memories were flying, being a fighter pilot.
How did your diagnosis impact your lifelong dream?
It was devastating. Everything I had done in life, everything I'd worked up to that point was just taken away in an instant. I was not prepared for that at all.
What does your support system look like?
Friends, your family, caregivers, you know, for me, the Medtronic Champions community, you know, all those resources that are out there help guide the way, but then help keep abreast on, you know, the new things that are coming down the pipe and to give you hope for eventually that we can find a cure.
Stick around at the end of this episode to hear my entire conversation with Mark. And you can hear more stories from Medtronic Champions and share your own story at medtronicdiabetes.com/juicebox. Diabetes comes with a lot of things to remember, so it's nice when someone takes something off of your plate. US Med has done that for us. When it's time for Arden's supplies to be refreshed, we get an email. Rolls up and in your inbox says, "Hi Arden, this is your friendly reorder email from US Med." You open up the email, it's a big button that says, "Click here to reorder," and you're done. Finally, somebody taking away a responsibility instead of adding one. US Med has done that for us. An email arrives, we click on a link, and the next thing you know, your products are at the front door. That simple. usmed.com/juicebox or call 888-721-1514. I never have to wonder if Arden has enough supplies. I click on one link, I open up a box, I put the stuff in the drawer, and we're done. US Med carries everything from insulin pumps and diabetes testing supplies to the latest CGMs like the Libre 3 and the Dexcom G7. They accept Medicare nationwide, over 800 private insurers, and all you have to do to get started is call 888-721-1514 or go to my link, usmed.com/juicebox. Using that number or my link helps to support the production of the Juice Box podcast.
Yeah.
Okay.
So a lot of pediatric emergency departments are split with main emergency departments, adult emergency departments. We are not. We are a self-standing pediatric emergency department. We get an adult. There's something wrong with them. We ship them out as soon as possible.
Okay. What do you see people most for? DKA?
Yeah, I want to say DKA.
Okay.
New diagnosis. We service 4 different states. So if there is a severe enough new diagnosis, they come to us, as well as the hospitals in the area. Even as far as, 200 miles across the state, will either life flight or...
To you. To a place where there's a nurse who's afraid of insulin, because you guys are the specialists.
Because we are the specialists.
Okay.
We are the pediatric specialists, yes. And I mean, it's not something to not be afraid of. It is afraid of. They should be.
Well, but yeah. I mean, Aurora, I'm not going to argue with that. But that would be like a mechanic being afraid of a lug wrench, wouldn't it?
I don't know.
I mean, you use it all day long, every day. It's in your hand constantly. How can you be confused by it?
Well, there is a portion of it, too. Is like you have to take a glucose, right? Mm-hmm. You put the glucose. There's a freaking calculator. You also have to make sure that the residents, because we have med students, we have residents, and they have, 3 years of residency. Then we have a fellow who's above them, and then we have an attending, okay? But the low man on the totem pole is the one putting in the orders. They're the ones calling endocrine. So you have to trust that your resident is putting in the correct order. Then you have to double check that their orders are correct. Then that you're putting in everything correctly. You also have to check the ketones, which we call a bob because it's a finger poke. So you have to check the ketones. And whether or not the ketones are medium, small, or large, you have to then put in, and we have a thing for that. And then it'll calculate, let's say if we're on sick day, what if it's 1.5 or double the dose, right? So you have to make sure that is all correct. And so that could have been what she was saying, being scary of giving it.
Yeah, so that's what I was getting at. Like, so it's possible that she's not wary. She's wary that the person telling her what to do is messing it up.
Oh, yeah, all the time. Every order that comes in, whether it's anything, it's not just diabetes orders. Yes.
Why am I worried that the orders coming in might be wrong?
Human error.
How often does it happen, though?
Oh, all the time.
Like per patient? Or how do we want to break it down? Is it like every person that walks in there, somebody's going to make a mistake about them? Or in every shift, I'm going to see a mistake?
I'm not saying like a mistake. I'm saying within orders that come in, as a nurse, every order that comes in for me to do something, I take a look at, and I'm going to say at least twice with every patient that I have questions on orders, and one or two of them is incorrect and they have to put it back in correctly.
We can't call that a mistake, a bad order from a doctor or a resident?
It's not a mistake because we're catching
it's a
learning process because they're learning.
Yeah.
They're babies.
Sorry.
Right?
Yeah. This is a legal distinction. But okay, so you stop it from actually being a problem, but a mistake was made that gets caught down the line. I see.
Now the nurse is the last stand, is the last person to do anything, to touch that patient. So therefore, the nurse is the last stopping point.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. All right. So I understand. So the resident who's maybe the least qualified is making the decision. And then the nurse is double checking those decisions to make sure they're not messing up. But in your words, twice with each patient, you might find something that needs to be readjusted?
Yeah, if I'm being generous.
Oh my God. Okay, that's fine. So if I get a nurse that doesn't know and a resident that doesn't know, that's when I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
Do they try to pair them in a way that doesn't happen? Like more?
No, but no. My hospital is really good at, or my charge nurses are really good at managing patient load. And if you don't, we do have a culture of like everybody's learning, and there's never a stupid question. There is never, don't not ask the questions, ask the questions, ask for help, and it's there.
Yeah.
So, giving this insulin, insulin's always a double check. We go through it. She's like, I've already gone through it. Can you go through it again? Let's draw it up. Let's give the insulin, right? Okay. Yeah, no problem. And, usually it's totally fine getting all of those steps in to be able to do that.
Does it go through, like, channels? Like, the resident sends something down, it's not right. You catch it. Is it a thing that you put back into the computer? Or do you, like, grab them on the side and go, hey, this isn't right?
Yeah. Yeah, or I call them, or I call their attending. And, I mean, so the residents do talk to the fellow and to the attending, as well as the nurses as well. So we all sit within, we're in an emergency department. Our providers are not in a room half across the hospital. They're there with us, right? So we can easily say, hey, this order is wrong. Please fix it, right? This is why it's wrong. And they all do talk together. It's not just the residents making the decision, but like the residents, the one putting in the orders.
Mm-hmm. What would you be most comfortable coming into your ER with a child with? Like, what do you think's like, what do you guys do great? Like, you know, you go to Five Guys, they make a great burger. When I come to your ER department, if I brought my kid in there, what would I be best bringing a kid in there with? What do you guys do well?
I think we do a lot of it well.
Okay. So is this just a fact of the situation that things get dropped and other people catch them?
Yes.
You're not saying this is bad. You're saying this is how it works.
Yes.
Okay. Are you comfortable? Would you be comfortable taking your child to that ER?
Yeah. I don't have children and I can't have children, but yeah.
You'd be comfortable going there.
I'm also a nurse myself, so that's a hard question to answer. Like, I wouldn't take my child in until they were absolutely dying, you know?
Why?
Why?
Because
A lot of things don't need to go to the doctor for.
Not because they would do a bad job once you got there.
Correct.
So is a lot of the backup in the ER just people going to the ER when they don't need to?
Correct.
What are things that people go to the ER for that they should have stayed home for?
Your kid has a fever. They've had a cough for 2 days. They're not eating.
Do people ever come in with those concerns and then it turns out to be something?
Very rarely. I feel like in an emergency department, we have levels for care and what you're going to need. So when you get triaged, your nurse assigns you, it's called an ESI level, assigns you an ESI level. So one is you are back in our recess room and you have, you know, four nurses on you, all the doctors available, a respiratory therapist, and we are putting in lines, we are drawing labs, we are getting scans, doing all of the things at once, right? This is the like Grey's Anatomy, you're crashing, okay? That's an ESI level one, and that can be a breather, that can be like a medically complex child who is just like looking like absolute crap, a diabetic who is having cerebral edema, we've had that a couple of times, you know, kids who are coming in seizing and the seizing is not stopping, fentanyl overdoses, those sorts of things.
Wait, fentanyl overdoses with little kids?
Oh, yeah. Cardiac arrest, that's another one. Respiratory arrest.
In the course of a shift, how long's a shift? 12 hours?
12.
How many heart attacks do you see in 12 hours in children?
It's very rare to have a heart attack in a child. They would usually have some form of
like birth defect or something, maybe underlying
cardiac problem, yeah. Or it's a middle of the night. They went into cardiac arrest or while they were sleeping, like a SID situation. And so we're resuscitating them, trying to get life back. So they come and they go. There's not a specific amount in a shift.
In a month, how many fentanyl overdoses? Two or three in a month. And how many shifts do you work a week?
Three.
So 12 shifts, two or three overdoses.
Yeah, or marijuana overdoses, which parents, please, I know the like marijuana comes in great packages and gummies and stuff. Please put them up in your cupboards far, far away. Put them in a lockbox. Kids get into them. They don't realize your kid comes in and we think it's meningitis and we find out it's marijuana.
Oh, my God. So more frequently than I would imagine, kids get into gummies of their parents?
Yes.
And those kids are high as f***ing, and they bring them to the emergency room.
And they look like they're dead, yeah.
Oh, because they're like...
They've overdosed on marijuana.
No kidding.
Yeah, we've had three in the last week. It's really bad.
Seriously. How come... All right, hold on. We're not going to go down the wrong path. But how do people not know not to leave that where their kids can find it? Well, I guess they're high too. Maybe they don't know.
I don't know. It's a PSA, please.
What else should people, maybe this is the road to go with you, or what else do people do where they shouldn't be doing? Like, what else is very preventable that you see?
We get a lot of nausea, vomiting, and abdominal pain. Or, teach your kids how to blow their nose, please. I know we went through COVID. I get we're not supposed to cough. You can cough into your shoulder. You can blow your nose.
Wait, people please aren't blowing? Wait a minute, people aren't blowing their nose?
Children, I had an 8-year-old who didn't know how to blow his nose, and I taught him how to blow his nose. He kept vomiting. We call it post-test vomiting if you're coughing, and then all of a sudden you vomit, right? Because mm-hmm. you get all that mucus that's going into your stomach. The mucus that's going into your stomach from your lungs, when you cough it up, is an irritant to your stomach, and it causes you to vomit.
You're saying if your child is vomiting because they can't blow their nose and everything's backing up down their throat, maybe you should reevaluate your parenting skills.
Yeah, you should teach your child how to blow their nose. Blow and their you know nose. What you do? You put the tissue on their nose and you block one nasal passage and you say, now try to close your mouth, but act like you're blowing out a candle. And oh my gosh, they can blow their nose.
Do you think people don't know that?
Absolutely.
Oh my God, well, that's upsetting. Okay. Jesus. All right, so they don't know not to leave weed near their kids. Edibles. Kids aren't eating the actual flower, are they, too?
The what?
The flower, the bud? Like, do they actually...
No. It's the gummies.
Gummies. Right. Okay. And worse, do kids get the harder drugs sometimes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, there are people who have drugs and you know, oxycodone, cocaine in their homes, and their children get around it, you know? And it's really sad.
No kidding. You ever seen a baby, like, really injured from that?
Well, what do you qualify as injured?
I mean... You know, they just stare at a wall for the rest of their life, or they're dead, something in between those things?
I don't know, because we don't...
You don't get to see them after that.
When I was upstairs, we would have, like, abuse from those that were afflicted with addiction who would hurt their child. I don't know about the children we're seeing now, because I don't deal with social situations.
Gotcha. But a number of the things you see in the ER would be preventable with somebody with an IQ over 80.
Somebody who didn't have social determinants of health that were ruling their life, yes.
You're very polite. Okay.
I mean, I truly believe that's what it boils down to, is social determinants of health. And I know other people who are healthcare workers that have come on for this have talked about it, but it surely is. If you don't have access to... your phone to be able to go to My Chart and message your provider, or can't get into the provider because they can't see you. Like, just a PCP visit in my area right now is 4 month wait time. Mm. I have been needing to see a specialist for a new autoimmune disease for 5 months now, and I'm still 1 more month away from this new appointment. It's ruining my life. Like, it's making it absolutely terrible and you can't get in.
Yeah, no, I want to talk about that, but that's not what I was getting at. I'm saying, like, we don't need to be any special kind of intelligent to keep weed away from babies or make sure they don't get an oxy or something like that.
No.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, how do you stop addiction? How do you stop that social determinant of health? What started that addiction?
I see what you're saying.
What in the system is causing this to be an end product?
What percentage of your day is wrapped around stuff that if those problems didn't exist for people, you wouldn't see these people? Like, how many people out of every 10 is it avoidable and not a health, like, not just a flat out thing that went wrong with their health that they couldn't stop? Does that make sense, my question?
Yeah. I'm trying to think. 2, 3?
So 2 or 3 out of every 10 people, if they just had better skills or opportunity, they would not be in the ER.
Oh, no, 7 then.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure how clear I asked it first. That's why I kind of restated it. So yeah. 3 of 10 are like, my appendix popped. That was nothing I could do about that.
Yeah.
I fell over. I broke my leg. There's nothing I could do about that. But 7 out of 10 are things that if you put a person with common sense and a reasonable start to life, this probably doesn't end up happening to them.
Yeah.
Is that frustrating as a nurse?
It can be.
Okay.
Not all the time. Sometimes it's, you know, new parents coming in. This is their first baby. They've never been around a child. And the child is sick for the first time. Okay?
Sure.
You've got the snot aspect. Patient's not breathing very well. They're not wanting to eat. They're a little sleepy. You know, mm-hmm. We unwrap them. We suction them really nice and well with our vacuum suction. And, you know, we let them eat. We give parents education, reassurance. Hey, you're going to suction every 3 hours. You're going to suction before they eat. And if the breathing gets worse, we give them a pamphlet. Like, this is what we want you to, this is where it's looking worse. Because you're giving a lot of information at once. Put it on your fridge.
Right.
So when you have that question, when it comes back up, It's right there. You know where it is. And then you can either come back in or you can be reassured by your baby's looking fine. Right. So like that is absolutely needed. That is probably one of my funnest things that I do is like giving those parents that education because it can prolong them not coming into the emergency department. It can prolong them not being worried.
So what I'm calling common sense, you're calling determinism. I guess this is just me judging things from my perspective, but you've described a number of things so far that I think with like 3 seconds of clear thought, I could figure out. But people are ending up in the ER over it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I've had children and sometimes you're right. Like they get sick and they get all snotty and they gets blocked up and then you like clear it for them.
Yeah.
That's it. It's not that hard. But I guess it is if it is, right?
I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's because we have such a good pediatric hospital in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody's just like, go to the hospital, right?
But isn't it expensive to go to the hospital?
Well, our hospital has, everybody can apply for assistance, and then it's based on income. So whatever level and whatever's left over from the hospital visit, how they determine it, I don't know.
Okay.
But a lot of it's uncompensated. Incompensated care? I don't know.
One time when Arden was little, she'll be very embarrassed that I said this, but that's her problem, not mine. She's very little. And she was in the bathroom and she didn't like the way it smelled. So she rolled up toilet paper and stuck it up her nose.
Solid.
Yeah. I mean, she's like, I don't know. She was not that old, like 2 or 3 years old. Right. But this one little wad of toilet paper got stuck so far up her nose, we couldn't get it out.
Yeah.
And so I sat her down and I looked at her and I thought with my thinker and I thought we tried one thing that I'm embarrassed to say that didn't work. We tried like putting like a funnel on the end of the vacuum cleaner hose to see if we could like grab it that way. Like, so there was like a little funnel tip that was being sucked on by the vacuum that didn't grab it. And then it hit me what to do. And I blocked up one of her nostrils, cupped my mouth over her mouth, blew in, filled her up with air, and the thing shot out and hit me in the face.
Yeah. You can also do that with mucus.
Yeah, I'm sure it can. Now, point is that at no point during this, like, show, which it was, did I think I'm going to go to the hospital? But you're saying people would come to the hospital with that?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. All right. I don't know what to do. So you're not here to tell me that the people at the hospital don't know what they're doing. You're here to tell me that the people coming to the hospital don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit of both.
It's a little bit of both. So
let's be honest.
Let's be honest. So again, the limiting factor here is people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Somewhere along the line, someone, I don't know, is overmatched, I guess is the simplest way to say it, for whatever reason. And they end up needing help from someone else who eventually sees this so many times over and over again that they become a little numb to it. And then another person comes in with an honest-to-God problem. And you don't see people like that anymore. You see, like, you see the confusion and the repetition. So when, like, do you know what I mean? Like, cause that's always one of my bigger questions is like, what happens when someone's actually in there with an actual problem?
Oh, I mean, all the resources go towards them and everybody else waits. That's how it works.
But how do they miss things that are actual problems in the beginning? They miss them because most of the time, 7 out of 10 times, it's nothing. Is that it?
Okay. So kids, especially, yeah. So pediatrics, like kids are really good at compensating. Their body is really good at compensating.
Right.
And like, so they'll be like, a little crummy, a little crummy, a little crummy, a little crummy. Right. And then they just, we call it a nosedive. They're on the edge of the cliff and something just pushes them down and they're crummy looking. It's, right.
Yeah.
And so parents know. And sometimes those like spidey senses are going off at a time that possibly is not that. And then sometimes they go off a little too late, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just like, there's no balance to it. But of course, if your kid is sick and they've been sick all week, and let's say they've had the flu, and we know the flu's going around, even though they've been sick all week, and you know it's the flu, parents still bring them in and say, fix my child. I'm sorry, it's a virus. We can't fix your child.
So do you think people get panicked when the illnesses start going on for many days and they think, oh, God, yeah, something worse is coming, instead of realizing that you got to ride this virus out?
Yeah.
And that sometimes people actually do have honest to God problems and everybody thinks that's happening to them.
Yeah. Let's say that they had a virus and now all of a sudden they're coming in and they have diabetes. Right. Then that's an emergency.
Right. Or you end up doubling up, like you get bronchitis on top of something else, or like you start having two problems at the same time. You know, so I don't think he'd mind me saying this. My brother had to go to the emergency room a couple of weeks ago and he had very terrible pain, that, you know, right side pain. And he gets there and they hit him with the drugs first, because he actually said, my brother's had some pretty like painful things happen to him. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I couldn't talk. Like, I needed like to numb this before I could even explain to them what was going on. So he gets, you know, they make him comfortable and he explains everything. They do all the tests. They can't come back with anything. But in his history, my mom has had diverticulitis in the past. And so they kind of ignore all that, go over him. And then he said there was this moment where they told him that even though he was in intense pain that was only being managed by some significant pain meds, there was nothing wrong that they could figure out, and he had to leave. He did have a raised white blood count, but they just they just kicked him out of the hospital. So he went home. And the next day texted me and he said, I can't take it. I got to go back. So he goes back again and he has to stop them from basically just repeating what happened 24 hours before. He has to say, no, we just did all this. If you need to see it, I'm sure it's in your computer, but we just did all this. I'm back because the pain is unbearable. You know, even with the medication you gave me, everything else. So he's there for another couple of hours. They're not doing anything. He's texting me. He's like, Scott, nothing's happening. They're going to just sit here and stare at me for a while and then tell me to go home again and go see a doctor. And I'm like, right. So I said to him, did they redraw your labs? And he said, they did. And I said, tell me if the white blood cell count is still elevated. And he looks and says, it's elevated. It's higher than yesterday. I said, grab the nurse and say, would it hurt anything if I got an IV antibiotic? You know, because my white blood cell count's elevated. It was elevated yesterday. Now today it's higher. My mom had diverticulitis in the past. She goes, hold on, I'll find out. She leaves, talks to the doctor, comes back. Doctor will be in to talk to you in a little bit. So my brother's like, hey, doctor's texting me. Doctor's coming to see me. He calls me afterwards. He's laughing. My brother's laughing. He goes, hey, I know what's wrong with me now. And I said, what'd they figure out? He goes, I have diverticulitis. Yeah. And I go, what? He goes, yeah. I floated the idea to the nurse, who floated it to the doctor, who came back and pretended that he had the idea that I had diverticulitis. And they're going to give me an IV antibiotic and antibiotics to take home with me. And I was like, so I diagnosed you? And he goes, yeah. Like, I'm the one, through a text message, who told my brother, manipulate the nurse so she'll manipulate the doctor so you can get the antibiotic, because obviously we don't know what's going on. The only thing we see is a rising white blood count. You clearly have an infection somewhere. Let's take care of it. The IV antibiotic's not going to hurt you anyway if that's not the thing. Why is this not worth a try? And by the way, 3 days later, he was fine.
Yeah.
I did that.
Yeah, manipulation's a good word for that. Yeah.
That's all I did.
I do a lot of manipulating at work.
Yeah, that's what I did. I manipulated a nurse through a text through my brother so that she would tell a doctor. And then, but I think the fascinating part that should not be lost on this is that an hour later, the doctor walks into the room as if he's had the idea.
Yeah.
And then repeats to my brother what I told my brother to tell the nurse.
Yeah.
Jump out a window. That's the only thing I can think of when I hear stuff like that. Just give up. Yeah.
That's my everyday. Yeah.
But you don't see it as bad. You see it as part of the learning process.
Oh, no, that's what I've been conditioned to.
Because I see it as bad. I just want to be clear.
I mean, it is like it's hard for me because I had so much experience in our hospital with this population for a very long time before I came down as a nurse. Right. So like I was above and still am. A lot of the nurses who have been there a long time. And I've been told that by management, which is fine. I have a very blunt personality. I'm very like, this is what we're doing and we're doing it now, right? That doesn't go over well with everybody. And so I have been told, you just have to play dumb. which some days I comply with. Most days I do not.
So the smart people say play dumb?
Yeah, because you have to ask things in a way that will get the providers to think what you're wanting them to think or give you the orders you need.
Yeah.
That you are advocating for the patient. Yes.
I mean, listen, I don't know what to say. In the last year, my brother and my daughter have been in the emergency room, and I have been the attending physician for both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And without me, nobody helps them. They pretend to help them. They medicate them. Then they throw them back out again. Aurora, my daughter was in the ER for 12 hours, and they didn't check her blood sugar while she was there.
I know. I listened to the podcast. Yeah. So I'm aware.
Ever once. They never even stuck their head in and said, hey, how you doing? How's your blood sugar?
Yeah. And that to me is surprising, but that's an adult emergency department. And I know the nurses get busy. I am triage trained now. I'm a full-fledged emergency department nurse. So I triage patients. I triaged a patient literally a couple days ago who came in, and she has type 1 diabetes. Okay. She goes, I don't feel well. I can't keep anything down. I think she came back with a virus. Okay. Not abnormal. Usually it's sick day. And she, I can't remember. She was like 8 to 11, somewhere in that age range. I can't remember which exact. It doesn't matter. So she's like, my blood sugars have been, 2 to 300s. We can't get them down. Well, the Lantus isn't working. Dad knows nothing. Nothing about her diabetes. Nothing about her care. And she goes, this is how much insulin I take. This is how much, Lantus I take. She goes, but this abdominal pain, it feels like the last time I was in DKA. And I was like, I got you, girl. I know what that feels like. Right. I know the pain you're talking about. And so we get her back to her room immediately. Her glucose, they had checked her glucose in the first check-in area, and it was above 300. I hand her off to the other nurse, and the other nurse is supposed to get all the labs and stuff. So they got the labs. She was in DKA at that time. By our standard, she was in DKA. Mm-hmm. Endocrine said, she's not in DKA. Do sick day. For whatever reason, and I don't know what happened, a glucose wasn't checked 2 hours later, and they went in to go do sick day insulin 3 hours later, and she was further into DKA. And so then we had to start the DKA two-bag insulin system.
Listen, the only direction my brother got in the first day of the hospital, my brother has type 2 diabetes, which is managed very well with diet, exercise, and Ozempic. So my brother's A1C is in the mid fives, from the sevens with Ozempic. He's lost 35 pounds in the last year or something like that. Like everything good about my brother's health right now is coming from his GLP medication. Mm-hmm. He's in the hospital. They do the tests. Then they go, oh, we don't see anything. And then the doctor says to him, I think maybe we should take you off the Ozempic. And my brother goes, why? And he goes,
why?
He goes, his words were, I've heard I was listening to a podcast, and I heard that they can cause like intestinal blockage. There's a lot of problems with intestinal blockages lately. And my brother goes, I don't have an intestinal blockage. I took a shit this morning. And the guy goes, he's like, it's on there. You asked me, when's the last time I went to the bathroom? Went to the bathroom a couple of hours ago. Like I don't have I am not blocked at all. I promise you. And the guy says, I don't know, maybe we should take you off of this. So my brother goes, I'm not stopping that medication. So the only medical direction he got was come off your GLP, which would have raised his A1C back up 2 points. And no one ever came back to say to him, hey, don't do that. So now my brother's a bright enough guy, and he's got me to bounce it off of and other people in his life, right? So, but there are plenty of people who would leave that hospital that day, and what they would remember is, the doctor told me to stop taking the Ozempic.
Yeah.
They would have stopped. It had nothing.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know if that's because we come from a background of having a chronic illness or taking care of someone with a chronic illness. And we're like, no,
How do you not understand it, though? Like, how can you say
I work
in medicine and I don't know? Well, I mean, what might be one of the most popularly understood drugs in the world right now? Like everyone, it's on everyone's lips. Everyone knows what it is. And yet you are just guessing based off a thing you might have heard once, and then you give somebody medical direction about it, then find out that's definitely not what the problem was, and don't go back to them and say, hey, by the way, I know I told you to stop taking the Ozempic, but don't do that. Like, it's fascinating. Like, no wonder people have so many problems. You know what I mean?
I think maybe it's just the oversaturation
of
patients to providers.
Just too many people searching for help, and it's more than a person can keep straight in their head.
Yeah.
That makes sense to me, by the way. Yeah.
I have a friend, and she's very lovely. I went to nursing school with her. Her son was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes last May.
Mm-hmm.
May, March, somewhere in there. Anyways, I texted her, and I was like, hey, happy birthday. And she goes, oh, my God, I was just thinking of you. We are in the emergency department. Not near me, because I went to nursing school in a different state. And she goes, we were just diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. And so they like went home after did some insulin because he was fine, and then did training the next day. And so she's calling, we're texting very frequently that first 2 weeks. And in the first 2 weeks, I was like, listen to this podcast. This is going to tell you more information than they're ever going to tell you. And I was like, get the insulin from the doctor. Get what you mean. I was like, but do not listen to the doctors. Like, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know anything about diabetes. And they're telling you, I'm going to say, all the wrong things. Right? She is a nurse.
Yeah.
She has patients with diabetes. She gives insulin on the daily. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so I saw her a couple months ago, and we went out for breakfast. And she's sitting there, and she's complaining about, like, these diabetic orders that she had the previous week, and they were completely wrong, and it took, you know, hours upon hours to get them correct. And then she was like, I just don't understand what they're doing. And I was like, and so how's your son's A1C? Like, what's going on there? Because, like, we kind of just stopped asking questions. And I was like, what's going on? She was like, oh, we're high, and this is going on, and, like, he's taking meals to correct because we can only correct every 3 hours, and then it's just causing bigger spikes. And I was like, what are you doing? Because, hey, I love you. I love your kid. But I told you a year ago, do not listen to the doctors.
So for a year, it goes on like that.
You just told me from your nursing experience, you do not listen to the doctors and do not trust the doctors.
But when she got put into that position, she did.
Correct.
Yeah. So there's a person who should know better and didn't. I'm telling you, like, what if my brother would have believed that guy? Now, all of a sudden, it's 6 months from now. He's back at his general practitioner. Guy goes, well, I don't understand what happened. Your A1C went way back up again. What's going on? And my brother goes, oh, I stopped taking Ozempic because the ER doctor told me to stop taking it because I might have a bowel obstruction. It's fascinating. By the way, they had scanned him to within an inch of his life. His bowel was not obstructed. They knew that. And then the guy still said it out loud. Mm-hmm. I don't know what I'm listen. I know people are just people, and you go to school and you do your best and you become a doctor. It doesn't make you a magician. It doesn't make you a god or a deity or anything like that. But isn't it incumbent upon you to know that when you're talking, that I'm just a guy, I'm just a girl, and I don't know everything, and whatever I say out loud, this person across me is going to take like gospel.
Yeah.
Like, it's important not to, seriously, it's important. It's, nobody seems to understand. Like, that's the thing that I find fascinating. The older doctors can get it, but they're so damn tired. Like, it's, like, either have people with energy that don't know what they're talking about, or exhausted people who know what they're talking about who can't bring themselves to do it anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's the answer? How do you fix it?
We all die eventually. I don't know.
It was going to get you anyway, Scott. Yeah. So there's no answer, right? This is just a gray area within living and society that is probably working as well as it can and not working badly. I mean, it's obviously not. It's not where it could be, but there's no answer about how to get there. As far as anybody I've spoken to so far, I've never had one of these conversations at the end said to somebody, what do you think we should do? And they go, oh, I have a great idea. They all go, I don't know. Like, you know, it's the insurance, it's insurance fault. It's the time that doctors have with them. It's doctors' egos. It's, you know, that there's too many people.
You know, in nursing school, we learn about I think it was the early 1900s. Okay. Nurses would go to people's homes. They would check in and I'm not putting this on the nurses because we already do everybody's job, but nurses would go to, they would have a set amount. This was in New York, I believe. Set amount of patients that they would see within a week, within a day, right? They had these families that they were like the mama bear of, okay? She would go in and make sure that the moms were getting enough food so she they could breastfeed. They would make sure that the patients who needed the dressing changes would do the dressing changes and make sure that like people, even if they don't have enough money, are getting adequate food and just kind of like being a part of the community that they were supporting, right?
Okay.
They were there, they were in the community, they lived close to these people. This was their, you know, like this is what they did, right? There was federal funding for that. And then something happened and that federal funding was lost. But in that time frame, the health, the disease rates were better. People were, you know, like not spreading sexually transmitted diseases because they were learning not to, you know, do those things, whatever. My blood sugar's going low.
Is it? You want to stop and do something?
Yeah, I'm going to just go grab something.
Go ahead. Yeah, I gotta do that. I'll be here. I feel like she was getting ready to say they don't let. Take your time. Make sure you're okay.
Yeah, I'm fine. I'll just drink some.
I was telling the people when you walked away, it felt like you were about to say people knew not to let dirty near them. And then you were like, I'm going to stop for a second. Hold on a second. Is that what you were going to say?
No. My phone is on. It's on. I put it on airplane mode or whatever that is. Do not disturb. And so it was just alarming me. I was.
Oh, you got confused in that sentence. You got the alarm. Because you paused. Yeah. I was like, oh, she was going to say something hard and she stopped herself. But your alarm went off. What's your blood sugar?
64.
Most people get high when they're being interviewed.
Yeah, I did initially. And I gave myself a bolus.
A little too much.
That's what the pump said to do. No, I've calmed down, and so I'm no longer spiking adrenaline to keep it up. Anyways, so they had these wonderful nurses who would do the actual community outreach, and it was cut. Of course it was, for funding. Mm-hmm. And we've never gotten back to any state close to that. And I honestly believe if we, as a country, were to do that, A, our nurses would be so much happier. And find so much more fulfillment in what they're doing. And then we would have less hospitalizations. We would have less heart disease. We would have less type 2 diabetes, right?
Like, so you think the answer is one-on-one care with somebody who can talk to you on your level and isn't rushing around and actually understands the thing, so specialty, like they understand the thing they're talking to you about because they don't have to know everything. They only know a few things.
Or not even just a few things, but like...
the things that come up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean...
not a bad idea, right?
I honestly believe that I would love... it's public health nursing is what it is. I would love to do that.
Okay.
But public health nursing now is not that.
Yeah. Everything gets bastardized eventually. Even like walk-in clinics, right, that take insurance, like, you know, eventually they become a grind, like a mill.
Yeah.
But when they first opened up, it was great. It was like you'd show up somewhere and the doctor would be like sitting there waiting for you and be like, hi. And now as time goes past, they seem a little more get them in, get them out. I mean, at least there's a little more time for them because they don't have as many people there as an emergency room. And people seem to have learned how to use, you know, those clinics a little bit, but you could also get a bad one. I've been in one with my son when we were in Florida and he got sick. And my God, like there was just confused people everywhere. And I mean, working there and very unhelpful. And then there's one near my home that's actually really good. Actually, there's a type 1 that works in it and she's terrific. And if I go there when I'm sick, I'm like, is she here? And, you know, she's really great. Maybe even that's a little bit about what you were talking about earlier, just your opportunity and your availability to good help and good ideas. So maybe I just live in an area that, you know, I don't know, has a better emergency clinic to go into, not even attached to a hospital. Who knows? But I like your idea though. Like, what did you call it? Community nursing?
Yeah, it's public health nursing with like community specific outreach.
They probably can't charge for that well, though.
I don't know.
That's probably the problem. So basically, it's like having a Facebook community, but where an actual nurse shows up and helps you.
Correct.
Yeah. I see.
Which is like, it's, you know, you become a nurse and like you get all these text messages from people and they're like, blah, blah, blah. You know how many phone calls I've gotten in the middle of the night where my sister's kids are doing something funky or they're screaming their head off and she's like, I need your help. Mm-hmm. She lives halfway across the country. Okay, let's FaceTime them. I'll look at them. Okay, they're okay. This is what you should look for. This is what you should give. If they start doing this, then go to the emergency department.
Okay. Yeah.
So but if you're really concerned, call your PCP tomorrow and try to get in. Right? Like, but not everybody, again, social determinants of health. Like, nursing school is very expensive. Having a doctor in the family, not a normal thing. Who are you going to call? Right? If you live in a lower class population, if that's where you are, how do you even reach that? How do you have a nurse in your phone to know?
Yeah. The guy you know to help you when you know when you need
questions to ask.
Yeah. When you need a I know a guy situation, the guy you know is maybe not a doctor. Yeah. And then all right.
I mean, like, I've literally, like, my sister has a running tab of how much money she owes me because I'm like $30 every time you call me with a question because this is ridiculous, you know?
But is she calling you because she's overmatched or is she calling you because she really doesn't know and she'd be one of those people in the ER if she didn't call you? What do you think?
I think a little bit of both.
A little bit of both. She's taking advantage a little bit and a little bit she doesn't know what she's doing.
Yeah, which is why I literally told her and her husband this last week because I was there visiting. I was like, $30. I'm not kidding you. Because my brain and my availability is not just free to you because I am related anymore. You got a year and a half out of me. No more. You got three kids now.
I know a doctor and he said that's, you know, it's one of the worst things is that, and when you know him, you have to stop yourself sometimes because you're like, oh my God, I could just ask real quick. You know what I mean? Yeah,
I mean, I think it's really appropriate to set a boundary. And I mean, I gladly will do it. Like,
sure.
Of course, she's not ever going to pay me. But, you know, like people don't have that.
Yeah.
We didn't have a nurse in my family until I became a nurse. You know, we didn't have anybody who'd graduated high school until I graduated high school. Like,
really?
People don't have it. Oh, yeah.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, well, good for you. Congratulations.
Thanks.
And good for your family, too.
If you come from a background like that, what do you do? Well, you go to the emergency department and you sit there for 4 hours until you can see a doctor who's going to tell you, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Come back if you need to.
Yeah. All right. Well, again, I appreciate the conversation. I'm afraid they're all going to mostly go the same way, but everybody's bringing something new and different to them. Your perspective was different than others so far, so I really appreciate you taking the time to share it with me. I'm sorry you got low in the middle of it, but thank you very much. It's interesting, and I will say this because I say this all the time in these episodes. If you have an emergent situation, just go to the emergency room.
Oh, for sure. Please do. Don't act like I'm not saying don't go to the emergency department. Right. Like, kids get, like I said, they fall off cliffs. So go. If you think you need to go, go.
Right. And it's better safe than sorry. I mean,
correct.
For certain. You know what? It's just, there's a difference between, like, you know, that old, like, oh, I shot 10 units of fast acting instead of my basal insulin. What do I do? And right away, someone online will be like, go to the emergency room. And I'm like, you could figure out what your carb ratio is and eat the food.
Drink a bunch of juice.
Yeah. Like, there's other stuff you can do. And then you'll say, they'll go, oh, that's a good idea. I'm like, yeah. Yeah. You don't have to run to the emergency room immediately. That panic that some people have is interesting. Like, you know, I'm not saying if you can't get ahead of it, if you, you know, if you're, you know, you shot 30 units or something like that. Like, I get it. You know what I mean? But you got to think for yourself a little bit once in a while. I guess unless you can't, and then maybe you need somebody to do it for you. But that just means that people like Aurora are going to be like teaching your kids to blow their nose, and you're going to be using up the finite amount of she has to give before she falls apart at her job. Like, really, right? Like, eventually you're just going to run out of to give, and then
and then it comes in and dies, and you just like actually lose your marbles because
who knows? My gosh! All right, I'm going to say goodbye and thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mark is an incredible example of what so many experience living with diabetes. You show up for yourself and others every day, never letting diabetes define you. And that is what the Medtronic Champion community is all about. Each of us is strong, and together, we're even stronger. To hear more stories from the Medtronic Champion community, or to share your own story, visit MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox. Don't forget, we still have Mark's conversation at the very end. It's a terrific kind of mini episode, about 10 minutes long, that goes deeper into some of the things that you heard Mark talking about earlier in the show. A huge thanks to US Med for sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box podcast. Don't forget, usmed.com/juicebox. This is where we get our diabetes supplies from. You can as well. Use the link or call 888-721-1514. Use the link or call the number, get your free benefits check so that you can start getting your diabetes supplies the way we do from US Med. I want to thank the Eversense CGM for sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box podcast and invite you to go to eversensecgm.com/juicebox to learn more about this terrific device. You can head over now and just absorb everything that the website has to offer, and that way you'll know if Eversense feels right for you. eversensecgm.com/juicebox. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode of the Juice Box podcast. And now my full conversation with Medtronic champion, Mark. Mark, how old were you when you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes?
I was 28.
28. How old are you now?
47.
47. So just about 20 years?
Yeah, 19 years.
What was your management style when you were diagnosed?
I used injections for about 6 months, and then my endocrinologist in the Navy recommended a pump.
How long had you been in the Navy?
See, 8 years up to that point.
8 years.
Yeah.
I've interviewed a number of people who have been diagnosed during service, and most of the time they're discharged. What happened to you?
I was medically discharged. Yeah, 6 months after my diagnosis.
I don't understand the whole system. Is that like honorable?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, essentially, if you get a medical discharge, you get a commensurate honorable discharge. I guess there could be cases where something other than that, but that's really how it happens. So it's an honorable discharge but because of medical reasons.
And that still gives you access to the VA for the rest of your life, right?
Correct. Yeah, exactly.
Do you use the VA for your management?
Yeah, I used to up until a few years ago when we moved to North Carolina. It just became untenable. Mm-hmm. Just the rigmarole and process to kind of get all the things I needed, you know, for diabetes management. It was far easier just to go through a private practice.
Was it your goal to stay in the Navy for your whole life, your career?
It was. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I think a few months before my diagnosis, my wife and I had that discussion about, you know, staying in for the long term. And, you know, we'd made the decision despite all the hardships and time away from home. That was what we loved the most. So that's what made it that much more difficult.
Was the Navy a lifetime goal of yours or something you came to as an adult?
Lifetime goal. I mean, as my earliest childhood memories were flying, being a fighter pilot, and specifically being flying on and off aircraft carriers. So, you know, watching Top Gun in the 80s certainly was a catalyst for that.
You've taken off and landed a jet on an aircraft carrier?
Hundreds of times.
Is there anything in life as exhilarating as that?
No, but there's a roller coaster I rode at, Cedar Rapids up in Cleveland, mm-hmm. Sandusky. And they've got this roller coaster that takes you from zero to, I think it's like 80 or something. You go up a big hill and you come right back down. So the acceleration is pretty similar, I would say, to a catapult shot.
I'm going to guess you own a Tesla.
I don't. Oh, okay. I'm a boring guy. I got a hybrid RAV4. I get made fun of. I get called, you know, my wife says I drive like a grandpa. I'm a 5 miles per hour over the speed limit person. No more than that. So yeah, in the car, I'm boring, Scott.
So you've never felt a need to try to replace that with something else?
You can't replace it. It's irreplaceable.
That's what I thought.
So up until the point where someone, you know, buys me an F-18 or allows me to get inside a two-seater and fly it, you can't replace it.
How did it make you feel when you saw, or maybe you haven't seen, a gentleman named Pietro has his large aircraft license. He's flying for a major carrier now. He has type 1 diabetes. Does that feel hopeful to you?
Yeah, it does. You know, when I was diagnosed, that wasn't a possibility. The FAA prohibited commercial pilots who had type 1 diabetes. But I think it was 2017 when they changed their rules to allow type 1 diabetics to be commercial pilots. And part of the reason they did that was because of the technology advancements, specifically in pump therapy and pump management. So I don't have any aspirations of going to the commercial airlines, but one of my sons who has type 1 diabetes very much wants to be a commercial pilot. So, you know, in that respect, I'm very hopeful and thankful.
Yeah. Do you fly privately now for pleasure?
I do. Yeah. One of my favorite things to do is fly my kids to the different soccer tournaments I have all over the Southeast U.S. So last week, my wife and I and two of our boys flew up to Richmond for their soccer tournaments up there. And Charlie, who's my middle child, has type 1 diabetes. So, you know, if I can combine flying, family, and football in one weekend, to me, that's, I think I've just achieved Valhalla.
So then it sounds to me like this diagnosis was a significant course correction for you. Can you tell me how it affected your dream?
Well, I guess three words come to mind. First, it was devastating. Everything I had done in life, everything I'd worked up to that point was just taken away in an instant. And I was not prepared for that at all. The second emotion was it was scary. I hadn't thought much about life outside the Navy, certainly not life as anything else but a fighter pilot. And Heather and I were getting ready to move to France. I was going to do an exchange tour with the French Naval Air Force. So we were taking French classes. So pretty quickly, I had to reinvent myself. And then probably the most important thing at the same time that all that was going on, I had to learn how to deal with type 1 diabetes and how to manage it effectively. The third thing that pops into my mind, I guess, is challenging. You know, new daily routines I had to establish, first with injections and then eventually, you know, through pump management. And then learning how to count carbs and recognize highs and lows, how my body reacts to blood sugar trends based on exercise and stress and those types of things. And my goal at that time, and it still is today, is to leverage technology and make sure my habit patterns are effective so that I take diabetes management from the forefront to the background.
Have you had success with that? Do you feel like you've made the transition well?
I have. I mean, I believe in continuous improvement, so there's always more to do. I will say the technology since I was diagnosed, specifically with pump management, is just, it's just incredible. It takes less of me intervening, and it's really done by the pump itself and by the algorithms through the CGMs. And to me, again, that should be the goal for everybody, is to not have to focus so much on the daily aspects of type 1 diabetes management. You know, we should let technology do that for us.
What else have you found valuable? I've spoken to thousands of people with type 1 diabetes. The one thing that took me by surprise, because I don't have type 1 myself and my daughter was very young when she was diagnosed, I didn't really understand until I launched this podcast and then it grew into this kind of big Facebook presence. I heard people say, I don't know anybody else who has type 1 diabetes. I wish I knew more people. But until I saw them come together, I didn't recognize how important it was.
Yeah, I think similarly, I didn't know anyone with type 1 diabetes growing up as an adult up until when I was diagnosed. And then all of a sudden, people just came out of the woodwork. And when CGMs first hit the market, certainly within the last 5 years, it's amazing to me and my family how many people we've noticed with type 1 diabetes simply because you can see the CGM on their arm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say a month does not go by where we don't run into someone at a restaurant or an amusement park or a sporting event or somewhere where we see somebody else with type 1 diabetes. And the other surprising aspect of that is just how quickly you make friends. And I'll give an example. We were at a soccer tournament up in Raleigh this past Saturday and Sunday, and the referee came over to my son, Charlie, at the end of the game and said, "Hey, I noticed you were wearing a pump." And he lifted up his shirt and showed his pump as well and said, "I've had type 1 diabetes since I was 9 years old. I played soccer in college. I'm sure that's your aspiration. And I just want to tell you, don't let type 1 diabetes ever stop you from achieving your dreams of what you want to do." And this gentleman was probably in his, you know, late 50s or 60s. So just having that connection and seeing, you know, the outreach and people's willingness to share their experiences, it just means the world to us and just makes us feel like we're part of a strong community.
Yeah. So would you say that the most important things are strong technology, tools, understanding how to manage yourself, and a connection to others?
Yeah, technology for sure, and knowing how to leverage it. And then the community, and that community is your friends, your family, caregivers, you know, for me, the Medtronic Champions community, you know, all those resources that are out there to, you know, help guide the way, but then help you keep abreast on, you know, the new things that are coming down the pipe.
Yeah.
And to give you hope for eventually, you know, that we can find a cure.
You mentioned that your son wanted to be a pilot. He also has type 1 diabetes. How old was he when he was diagnosed?
So Henry was diagnosed when he was 12 years old. It was just at the start of COVID. We were actually visiting my in-laws in Tennessee. We woke up in the morning and he had wet his bed. And several years before that, we had all four of our boys tested for TrialNet. So, you know, predictor of whether or not they were going to develop type 1 diabetes. And Henry and one of his brothers tested positive for a lot of the indicators. So we always kind of had an inclination that there was a high degree of possibility he would develop it, but we always had it at the back of our mind as well. And so when that event happened at the beginning of COVID, we had him take his blood sugar on my glucometer and it was over 400. And so right away we knew that without even being diagnosed properly by endocrinologists that he was a type 1 diabetic. So we hurried home to get him properly diagnosed in Charlottesville. And then we just started the process, first grieving, but then acceptance and, you know, his eventual becoming part of the team that nobody wants to join.
How old is he now?
Yeah, he's 15 years old now.
When's the first time he came to you and said, is this going to stop me from flying?
Almost immediately. So like me, he always had aspirations of flying. In fact, he, out of all four boys, wanted to be in the military. And that was a difficult part of the conversation and maybe something that we don't talk about as a community. But there are some things you cannot do as a type 1 diabetic. And that's a hard fact of life. And unfortunately, joining the military is one of those hard and fast things. You cannot be join the military as a type 1 diabetic. So that was very difficult for him and for me and my wife to get over. Then we also started talking about being a commercial pilot. And so I saw that same excitement in his eyes because like me, you know, he can be in an F-18 or a 737 or a Cirrus SR-20 that I fly and be just as happy. Yeah. So he still has that passion today and still very much plans to eventually become a commercial pilot.
I appreciate you sharing that with me. Thank you. Do you have four children? Do any others have type 1?
They do. My oldest twin, Henry, has type 1 diabetes and my middle son, Charlie, has type 1 diabetes as well.
The boys are twins.
The oldest two are twins. One has type 1 diabetes. My middle son, who is not a twin, has type 1 diabetes.
I see. Is there any other autoimmune in your family?
There isn't. I'm really the only person in my family or my wife's family that we know of with any sort of autoimmune disease, certainly type 1 diabetes. So unfortunately, I was the first to strike it rich and unfortunately pass it along to two of my sons.
But celiac, thyroid, anything like that?
Nothing. We're really a pretty healthy family. So this came out of nowhere for myself and for my two sons.
That's really something. I appreciate your time very much. And I appreciate you sharing this with me. Thank you very much.
Anytime, Scott.
Learn more about the Medtronic Champion community at MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox or by searching the hashtag Medtronic Champion on your favorite social media platform. The episode you just heard was professionally edited by Wrong Way Recording. WrongWayRecording.com.